Fletcher was named GM in 2018, and he was the 9th GM in Flyers history. The team only made the playoffs once during his tenure. Now, this year, they have one of the worst records in the NHL, with many fans recently showing their frustration.
Every one of us is a walking museum of sports, from that first ball game with your folks to maybe getting that nervous, sweaty autograph, or maybe even taking your own kids to their very first game. It's the feeling that we all get that brings us back to our own personal Philly field of dreams. And the Museum of Sports Show is on the air and ready to go there with you. I'm Doug Scheimel, our show dedicated to sports memories, memorabilia, and the museum that's going to capture it all right here in Philadelphia. We're live on the Talk 860 and Museum of Sports Facebook pages, so check us out. Museum of Sports Show brought to you by the DePachi Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. And joining me, as always, from his sports bunker in Greater Villanova, he is our guide and mentor, Comcast Spectacor legend, founding vice president of the Philadelphia Flyers, and creator of the Museum of Sports, and author of the recent book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Lou Scheinfeld. Hiya, Lou.
Well, I received a couple of nice things this week, but not my tooth yet. It's only been 6 weeks, so sad, but tomorrow, Sam, I'm supposed to get a tooth. So, Sam, you know, in hockey, it was tough in the front office. So,
were you in a fight with Dave Schultz?
Dave Scott actually beat me up. Yeah. I wanted to share with you something I got, which really makes me feel good. I got a letter yesterday from someone who just finished my book. And one of the great joys, Sam knows, of writing a book is how people respond to it. Not if you made a couple thousand dollars or whatever, but just the people who Williams. Enjoyed it. And this fellow writes, his name is Barry Pollock from Elkins Park, PA. He said, "I just finished reading your book and I can't begin to tell you how much joy you brought to me. I am 80 years old and was able to relate to so many of the people, places, and things you spoke about in the book. You led an interesting life and I thank you for sharing it." And I thank him for sending this. That means more to me than a lot of things. In fact, my wife wasn't even complimentary, but neither was my first wife, but that's another story. I'll write that book later on.
Is this
on,
thing but. On? Can you hear me in the back? Yeah, but that's the whole reason, you know, that you write those sort of, tell all full frontal nudity books is to get that wonderful reaction.
I also heard from three lawyers who were suing me, but that's something else.
You know? Yeah. That's a whole show.
It was a beautiful read though. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, as you know, Lou. We've talked about it a lot. And for anybody who hasn't read it, pick it up. It's you can't put it down. Great, great job, Lou.
Thank you, Sam.
Absolutely. Hey, Museum of Director of Community Outreach, Susan Baxter, off today. Coming up, he's working on a new book about the 1982-83 76ers championship team. Author and sports writer Luke Eplin is going to be here for the first time in the Museum of Sports Show. And we've got what is hot, what is not, and what's affordable in the sports collectibles market with our own king of sports collectibles, whose family has the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection and our proud partner in the museum. Mr. Nick DePaccia Jr. will be here. But up first, he may have retired or transitioned or whatever the euphemism is he's using from hockey sports writing. But the Flyers just can't seem to escape him. He's the force behind PhillyHockeyNow.com. He's the longtime Inquirer hockey writer, and he's authored the Adam Taliaferro story and the Big 50, the Philadelphia Flyers. Here for a postmortem on the Flyers and whatever the hell else he wants to talk about, a big Museum of Sports Show. Welcome back to our good friend, Mr. Sam Carcitti. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've got the Phillies opening game that starts pretty much right now at the Texas Rangers. Yet, for some weird, morbid reason, we cannot stop looking at that wreck on the side of the highway that is the Philadelphia Flyers. And I guess you heard the clip from 10 days, 2 weeks ago about the firing of Fletcher and Danny Briere interim. And what were some of your feelings? Everybody seemed to, you know, the fans in particular were calling for heads to roll, and they started to.
Yeah. First of all, Chuck Fletcher's a very nice man, a good, decent man. But I think the firing was way well overdue. And I think they were too loyal to him to a fault. And, you know, I would have made the move before the season and, you know, given Danny Breer time to kind of start fresh at the beginning of a season. It's tough to get thrown in. And of course, he has the interim label right now. I think most people, myself included, expect that to be taken off and Danny to be the guy. But I think it's a lot tougher in the middle of the season to do that. And Chuck Fletcher did just an average job with the Minnesota Wild, and he did an average to below average job with the Flyers. And you know, I mean, you know, yes, he was handcuffed by injuries to some extent, but he did not build the depth on his team. And to me, one of the most puzzling things he did was not to clear cap space to get a Johnny Gaudreau here. And people say, well, why do you want a Gaudreau here, you know, if you're in a rebuild or should be in a rebuild? And I say you need a piece like that to build around. And they still need a proven scorer. And Danny Breer is going to have to go out and get one. I mean, it's nice to have a rebuild and have all these young kids, but you need somebody that's going to give you 35, 40 goals a year. You need a couple people like that. The team they're playing tonight, Ottawa, has that, and they're on their way up. The Flyers still need a proven sniper, a proven scorer, you know, and then all these other pieces will grow with him. So, you know, I think it was a puzzling tenure from Chuck Fletcher.
Well, that's what Ed Snyder brought to the team. He made the splurge, whether it worked out or not, but he spent big to bring in big names. And that they don't have that big picture, but they say the new guy, Dan Hilfert, is a big picture guy.
Yeah, I think Dan will do a good job. I had a chance to talk to him briefly at the game the other night. And everybody I've talked to people that work with him at Independence Blue Cross, and they say he gets things done. And, you know, you saw what he did bringing soccer here. And you know, they need somebody like that. For whatever reason, Fletcher was overly cautious, not only in the free agent market, but in the trade market. And it's a lot tougher now than it was when Snyder was here because of the salary cap. But still, you know, there had to be a lot more moves made. And Fletcher, you know, it's interesting because I talked to Chuck, I guess, about a week or two after he was hired. And I did a piece on him and how he got interested in being an administrator. And his dad, as you know, Cliff Fletcher, was a Hall of Fame general manager. And Calgary won a Stanley Cup with him as a GM, and he is in the Hall of Fame. And he said one thing he learned from his dad is if you make a bad trade, you know, jump right back in. Don't be afraid to make the next move. You know, you always have to look forward. And I thought that was interesting. And I thought he was going to be that guy. I thought he was going to be aggressive. But he was just the opposite. He really did not make moves. And you talk about the moves they made back in the day when they – picked up Flett and Lonsberry and DuPont and added different pieces. You know, Chuck, for some reason, didn't have the foresight. And again, I don't want to insinuate that it's easy right to do it, but hey, that's what you're paid to do. I mean, right, salary cap or not, you know, you have to be able to clear guys out of there and not sign these long these contracts really handcuffed him. I'm talking about contracts to Ristolainen and Sanheim and other guys too. You know, he made his own bed and I wish him well, but I think things will be better with Danny Breer here, and I'm optimistic with Dan Hilfert here as well.
What, with such a middling record coming in here, what was the attraction and why did they stick with him for so long?
You're talking about Chuck Fletcher, right?
Fletcher, yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, Dave Scott was real close to him, and I think probably too close to him. And they gave him a lot of power. They gave him a lot of authority. He was also the hockey operations guy besides being the general manager. And now they're going to split the jobs. To me, Ray Shiro would be ideal for the hockey operations job. I think he and Danny Breer would work tremendously together. Some people say, you know, let's not bring in a guy connected to the Flyers, you know, but Ray Shiro really, to me, is not connected to the right Flyers. I mean, of course, his dad was the famous coach of the Flyers, and Ray grew up in the Philadelphia area, went to Camden Catholic High School in South Jersey. And But he really had, that's the only tie he has. He never has never worked for the organization. So to me, he would be the ideal guy to be the hockey operations person. And Danny Briere would report to him if Danny Briere ends up being the full-time GM, which I think he will. That would give them a dynamic two guys. You want to have a young guy like Briere on his way up and a guy who isn't afraid to make moves and will be aggressive. And will admit, and he already has, that they need to do a major rebuild. And I think that was a good first step.
Lou, I know you've got a bunch of stuff for Sam.
Well, they really cleaned house between Fred Schaible passing away, Ed Snyder long gone. Clark, Barber, and Holmgren shunted it off to the side, if that's true, what I'm reading. And they're all wonderful guys, good advisors and proven players. But, you know, you talk about making moves, and we have three other teams in Philadelphia. They're not afraid to make moves. I mean, the Eagles wheel and deal. Dave Dombrowski, he has a fire sale every couple of weeks. And Morley at the 76ers, he makes the biggest deals ever. So Chuck Fletcher was just the opposite. And they need a guy that's going to break some balls, you know, and not be afraid. And like you say, you make a mistake, boom, clean it up, move on.
Yeah, and there are players. People say, hey, this team is going to miss the playoffs for a third straight year. They've won one playoff series in 11 years. What do they have to trade? They have a lot of players to trade. I mean, Travis Konecny, not that I'm advocating trading him, but you have to listen. I mean, he's at his peak right now. He still leads the Flyers. He's only played 52 games, and he's still leading the team in goals with 27 and points, I believe, 54. He was having a tremendous year. He was going to end up probably with 85 points, 38 goals, something like that. Travis Konecny could bring you a lot, and you have to listen. If you can get a first-round pick for him, a real good prospect like a Tippett type when they got him, and maybe a serviceable player, a young player with potential, you do it. I mean, I don't think anybody should be untradeable, and that includes Carter Hart. Not that I'm advocating trading him, but you could probably get two first-round picks for Hart and a real good prospect. Yeah. You have to listen. Do you want to keep Carter Hart? Yes, in a perfect world, but maybe you're not going to seriously contend for a Stanley Cup for 3 years, and you have to weigh that against it. So, and Danny Briere came out and said that, you know, no one is untradeable, and I like that. I think, to your point, Lou, I think he will be aggressive. Kevin Hayes is a guy that, you know, they all but advertised, you know, he's available, please take him, and nobody did. And, of course, his $7.1 million salary cap is the main reason. He's still a good player. But if you can move him, maybe get a third-round pick and clear that off the books. And, you know, you got Cutter Gauthier, who's at BC now. He could step in and play center, and you have Couturier back, and Morgan Frost has really improved, and it looks like he could be a good third-line center. You have to do things like that. You have to think out of the box. You know, you're not going to get what Hayes is worth because of his high salary, but if you can get, say, a third-round pick for him, I think you do that. And these are things that Danny Briere is going to have to reconcile in the offseason, but I think you will see him be very active.
You know, Sam, you mentioned, you know, 3 years before you contend for a Stanley Cup. Is that sort of the blueprint? Is that the best case scenario?
I think so. And Lou knows better than anyone how long it takes. I think people were shocked that the Flyers were able to win cups in 74 and 75 so quickly in their seventh year of existence. But I think the Flyers have some very good prospects in place right now. Owen Tippett has certainly blossomed, and Cam York has had a good quality year, and they're solid in goal. Pieces are there, but I would think, as I said, they still need a sniper. They still need help down the middle. They need lots of help on defense. I think you're going to see a major shakeup on defense, whether Provorov is traded or Travis Sanheim is traded. I think that needs to happen. Ristolainen, they gave him way too much money, and for a guy who's basically probably a third pairing defenseman. I know he's been playing on the second pairing, but you know, value wise, he's probably a third pairing guy. But I think you're going to see the defense shaken up. They need somebody to play to stabilize Provorov. So maybe Provorov goes. Maybe he's considered a guy you can get a lot for. So Danny's going to have a lot of work to do. But I think 3 years is very reasonable, Doug.
I think one of the moves they should do is to try to bring back Kate Smith. As you know, Sam, I think you wrote about it, that a lot of people canceled their season tickets when that happened. And there's still every day, every week, fans still complaining about the way they treated Kate Smith. And I think there is a way to bring it back. You meet with the community, you set it up where it was, you have a sign next to it that explains what happened and how we learn from that. And I think that will appeal. And I see fans saying, let's get rid of Gritty. I love Gritty. I mean, Gritty has nothing to do with the team.
I kind of do too.
Right. But Kate Smith, the fans miss Kate Smith.
Yeah, I agree. And as I wrote, if anybody wants to Google my story, you know, she was anti-racist. I mean, you know, she was a victim of her times, and a director told her to sing this song or not get paid. She was a 20-year-old kid. And as you know, she was the most popular performer in the country in the 40s. And she had not only a national radio show, national TV show, and she had many African American entertainers on, gave them their start. And she did so many things to fight racism. And I don't want to get into all that right now because people think, oh, you're going back in time. But you brought it up. So I will bow up a little bit on it.
That's how I got my teeth knocked out. Yeah.
But I get criticized all the time on Twitter. You know, you're living in the past. But I agree. And, you know, let's set the record straight. She was not a racist. And, you know, the Flyers just made a rapid decision because they followed the footsteps of the Yankees. And as I said, if you want to, I don't want to rehash the whole thing, but you can read the true story in my column about her and how she was just a real good person. But that's not the reason the Flyers are losing. Let's be real. I mean, you and I know that's not the reason they're losing. They're losing because they don't have the talent that other teams have. And for some reason, when they draft players like a Provorov or a Sanheim, they just aren't able to take it to the next level. Mm-hmm. You look at players on other teams, and they keep getting better and better each year. And that's something that Danny Briere and the staff has to figure out. Why aren't these players that are number one picks progressing like players on other teams? And you know, that's something that has to be rectified, no question about it.
Before we go, Sam, we've got a couple of minutes left. Number one, Kate Smith, the Bronze, is still, she's a lady in waiting in a warehouse not to be named, correct, Lou?
Correct. Yeah. Shrouded over with black tarp.
Yeah. One of the things you heard the big call for, you know, obviously with the front office changes and potentially dealing away, you know, quality players while they still have value, the prospects for selling the Flyers.
Yeah, it's funny. I was told, let's see, about 3 weeks ago, I met with some people and connected to the Flyers, and I was told, A, Chuck Fletcher's not going to be fired. I was also told that, B, Hilferty is not going to replace Dave Scott, because I brought that up. I said, it just seems natural to me. And I was also told that the team is not going to be sold. So if you follow the breadcrumbs, the team is for sale. Now, you know, I don't have any inside information, but all I'm telling you is two things were denied that I thought would happen, and they did happen. And selling the team was also denied. So, you know,
jackpot.
We'll see. But it wouldn't shock me, that's for sure. You know, there are a lot of interesting candidates out there that I know would love to buy the Flyers, including Dave Roberts' son, who's rather famous.
Tucker.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Philly, hockeynow.com, honcho and hockey writer and author Sam Carcitti, as always, you are an amazing insight. And when we hear about the sale of the Flyers, within the next 3 to 5 weeks. Everybody will know where they heard it right here first.
Thanks,
Sam.
Doug.
Thank you, Luke, so much, as always.
All right. Take care, guys.
Good seeing you. Hey, we want to make sure all of our viewers go to themuseumofsports.org to make a tax-deductible contribution so you can be a part of Philly's sports shrine today. When we come back, a new book on the 82-83 76ers championship team when the Museum of Sports show continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. Back in a couple of minutes.
It was 1967, and Philadelphia was in a rut. The economy, riots, Vietnam. That is, until the Broad Street Bullies rallied the region's spirits and brought more than 2 million into the streets to celebrate. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's candid memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You'll love the inside stories about Frank Sinatra, Ed Snyder, Bernie Parent, Frank Rizzo, Elvis Presley, the 76ers, Mick Jagger, Electric Factory Concerts, and Kate Smith. And you'll find out how Lou Scheinfeld helped Ed Snyder rescue the Flyers and, against all odds, got the Spectrum built. Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed first edition copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. The book the Philadelphia Inquirer called a fascinating and hilarious read. Blades, Bands, and Ballers.
1 minute till the clip.
An ode to a building that truly rocked. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas Depatche is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat heart disease, hypertension, palpitations, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Dr. Nicholas Depatche, MD-FACC, author of 4 books and over 100 articles and abstracts at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Did you miss a recent Museum of Sports show? No worries. You can see or listen to any of our previous shows on the Museum of Sports website or on our Facebook page. You'll love our lineup of great guests, including Merrill Reese, the Eagles' Vi Sekahema, Bill Berge and Kevin Riley, Flyers broadcasters Jim Jackson and Steve Coates, and the Phillies' always colorful Larry Boa. The Museum of Sports is on the air and Facebook, and you can join the fun every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860 and Facebook Live.
Julius has his ring. Moses Malone did what Philadelphia wanted him to do. The champions of the NBA 1982-83.
We're back on the Museum of Sports show here on Talk 860 and the Museum of Sports Facebook Live page is brought to you by Depatche Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. I'm Doug Shimel, along with Lou Scheinfeld. Susan's off this week. Mm-hmm. Our next guest stories have been published in The Atlantic and The Washington Post and The New Yorker, and he's appeared in such broadcasts on NPR Weekend Edition and ESPN. And he is in the process, and maybe he'll give us an update on where the book stands. He's writing the book, actually was the author of the book, Our Team, about the integration of the 1948 Cleveland Indians. And now, for some reason, for a guy who was born and raised in rural Illinois, or so says his bio, he's got this fixation on a book about the 82-83 76ers championship team. So, ladies and gentlemen, as a first timer on the Museum of Sports show, big Museum of Sports show, welcome to Mr. Luke Eplin. How you doing, Luke?
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So I've got to ask you, as I mentioned, you're originally from rural Illinois. It kind of sounds like an Abraham Lincoln story. but you looked obviously at the Cleveland Indians for our team, and you're looking at the 76ers championship team 82-83. And I was waiting for the Cubs or the White Sox or the Bears or the Bulls or something like that. That's all the short form stuff.
Mike Ditka.
I'm actually from Southern Illinois. And so
that's a whole nother country.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I put rural Illinois, because it's nothing to do with the Chicago folks up there. I'm a big St. Louis fan. My dad had season tickets to Cardinal games when I was growing up. And my grandfather, during World War II, used to work in an airplane factory in St. Louis, and he was a big fan of the St. Louis Browns. You might remember that St. Louis used to have two baseball teams, the Cardinals, who were usually pretty great, and the Browns, who were almost always terrible. And my grandfather was an odd man in that he loved the Browns. And so whenever I grew up, you know, this would be decades after the Browns left St. Louis to go to Baltimore, where they became the Orioles. My grandfather would tell me stories about the Browns, and he would always talk about this last owner of the team who brought little people to the plate, who exploded fireworks, who allowed the fans to manage from the grandstands. And of course, that is Bill Veeck.
And, Eddie Goodell. Eddie Goodell was his name. He's 1'9", I think.
I mean, the idea was that that his strike zone was so small that no pitcher would be able to do anything but walk him. And so, I grew up hearing these stories about this wild owner that was the last owner of the St. Louis Browns. And so my intention was to write a book about him. And what I learned from sort of doing a little bit of preliminary research was that Bill Veeck owned the Cleveland Indians before he owned the St. Louis Browns. And what he did there 75 years ago was integrate the Cleveland team. They were the first team after the Brooklyn Dodgers to be integrated, the first team in the American League. And so I thought to myself, wait a minute, Bill Veeck, we talk about him with the sort of little person and all these wild stunts that he did, but the most significant thing he did in Major League Baseball was integrate the American League. And so that's where I started to think about a book based on him that would tell sort of an alternate story of integration than the one that we normally hear, which is centered around Jackie Robinson.
So where did the interest, or what sort of lit your fire for the 82-83 Sixers team?
So what happened was, well, there were two things. While I was researching this book, Our Team, that you had mentioned, it really details in particular the 1948 Cleveland Indians season. This was 75 years ago this year, and they became the first integrated team to win the World Series. And if you look at sort of whenever they did it, it was right between these sort of long periods of New York Yankees dominance. The Yankees would win in 47, Indians would win 48, then the Yankees would win four straight after that. And so it was kind of like a little bit lost in history between this sort of Yankees dynasty. And so I started looking at basketball, which is my favorite sport, more so than baseball. And I was thinking, what team was kind of like that, where, like, outside of its own city, we probably don't remember it as strongly because there are these other teams that sort of overpower that. And so I was thinking, well, when we think about the 1980s, we think about the Celtics and we think about the Lakers, and perhaps at the end, we might think about the Pistons, Bulls. But within there, the Sixers were just on that level of the Celtics and Lakers, and they just had some really bad luck, some of it of their own doing. But then you take that sort of 83 team in between that Celtics and Lakers dominance, and it's kind of like, well, what happened there? And so that was kind of where I was picking up the thread. That's how that the two sort of interrelate.
And then it was 40 years ago.
There's been a lot of good teams. So there's been a lot of good movies that have won the Oscars, a lot of good movies that didn't win the Oscars. And they don't stick in your mind. Same exact parallel there. I'm sorry, we're good.
And that was 40 years ago last week. And the 76ers organization brought the team back. And Detroit happened to be in town, and Maurice Cheeks is an assistant coach on at the Detroit Pistons. And he came to the Sixers locker room to take part in some of the festivities, came out on the court. And it was good to see him. And that was a heck of a team with Irving and Moses Malone, just a great all-around team. And you see right behind me, I have an autographed shirt of from Julius in that era. I had been the president of the 76ers for the 2 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. And Luke, first of all, thank you for sending the book. I love it. I've started it and I love it. But that year was fantastic. Harold Katz was the new owner of the team, having bought it from Fitz Dixon. And he infused some enthusiasm. He made the big trade. That was a very interesting year. And it was not a great time in Philadelphia either, with the recession and the racial strife and everything. But that team stands out, really stands out.
Yeah, the thing that really sort of piqued my interest about that team is that you had Julius Irving, the great Dr. J, who is, I think, probably the best finesse player of his era, really the person that revolutionized the idea that basketball could be played in the air. And he, when he came to Philadelphia in the sort of mid to late 70s, there was this idea that he was just going to sort of win tons of championships. In fact, the Sixers, of course, had that infamous slogan after they lost to the Trailblazers in 1977, that we owe you one. Because they were just so confident that Julius was going to lead them to that sort of promised land. And he almost did three different times. He's at 77, they made it to 1980, and then they made it again in 82. And each time they kept filling up short. And so them signing Moses Malone kind of was the perfect complement to Julius Erving. Moses was force, Erving was finesse. Erving was this sort of slick, smooth, very cool individual. Moses was down and dirty, blue collar, sort of grunting. Like he was just this wonderful opposing force to Erving. And whenever you put those two together, it became almost just this, like they unlocked this force in the NBA and just rampaged the title, as Moses said, fo, almost did that. And so it was just this wonderful sort of pairing of two superstars who, I mean, they really could have clashed because Moses was an MVP. Julius was an MVP. There could have been sort of egos involved, but they didn't. They were just the yin to the yang. And it's very rare that you see that sort of great complementarity in the NBA.
Well, you know, you mentioned Pat Williams took credit for coming up with that line, we owe you one. And the next year they didn't get, and he said, we owe you two. So it was and then they had another slogan that the seat you'll never sit in. And that because few people came to the game, a lot of empty seats. So.
Yeah, actually, I should mention that I talked to Lou on the phone last week. And that was one of my big questions that I had for him, because if you sort of read the archives and the newspapers at the time, everywhere Dr. J played in the Sixers, of course, it was sold out. They would go to Los Angeles to be sold out. They go to Phoenix to be sold out, Denver, whatever. They come back to Philadelphia and they'd have 7,000 to 8,000 people. And I was just like, why was Philadelphia not as supportive of this team as others?
I mentioned to you that I think the ownership had a lot to do with it. Fitz Dixon was a white socialite who was a bit of an elitist, and he was not a good face of the team. And Philadelphia was in a recession at the time, and the Sixers were, it's like the Flyers today. The Sixers now are the golden team, and the Flyers are on the side of the road, as Doug said, a car wreck. But the fans did not take to that team. I was president, and I couldn't fill those seats. It was embarrassing. And as I said to you on the phone, we were selling out on the road. And so I sold all our preseason games to other cities. So we sold out preseason games on the road because they wanted to see this fantastic team. And that's strange.
Yeah, that is strange. The other thing I really like about this team is that they're really the only championship team that whose superstars came from the ABA, the American Basketball Association. You look at sort of Bird and Magic, they came into the league, the NBA, after the merger between the NBA and the ABA, which happened before the 1976-77 season. And then you sort of see some of these other champions, the Bullets, the Sonics, that happened during that time. None of them were led by ABA stars. And so there was this sort of myth that was going around that the ABA was an inferior league with just a bunch of hot-dogging players, and that the sort of like individual style basketball that they practiced was not a sort of winning type of basketball. And unfortunately, Julius Erving got saddled with that he was a very incredible individual showman who could not lead his team to the championship. And so having Erving and Malone also started in the ABA, win it like they did, really redeemed not only the league, but a specific style of play, which I think is the style of play you see now, which is a very sort of airborne, sort of one-on-one, you know, showy sort of way about it. Like, I think the ABA really pioneered that. And so having the Sixers win was meaningful, not only to, you know, these two great superstars, but also in terms of like the styles that they pioneered.
Are you following the current team at all?
I am. In fact, I was very lucky enough to be there last Monday, whenever the 40th anniversary of the team. And I was blown away by the energy in the building. I mean, it's amazing how much the Sixers fans seem to be behind this team.
Every game.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Luke, as you kind of continued your research, was there anything that stuck out or surprised you along the way, even if it was just what you thought was going to be baseline research for this book?
Well, I really want to focus more on the points that Dr. J and Moses Malone intersect. And I just finished researching a tremendous sort of period. They faced each other in the 1977 playoffs, the Rockets versus the Sixers. And this was one round before the Sixers advanced to the finals. And there was a writer in Philadelphia who said that the Rockets will never beat the Sixers because they're a bunch of water buffaloes. And like that was the way that they characterized them, led by Malone, the chief water buffalo. And he said, a water buffalo will never beat a cheetah. And that's what he called Irving, a cheetah. And so that kind of became a rallying cry within Houston, that they were sort of these water buffaloes who played this very grinding, slow, methodical sort of play versus the Sixers, who had this very sort of fast, sleek, fast-breaking style where they were sort of running all up and down the court. And so it again, sort of like these styles that Irving and Malone were cultivating were sort of in play long before they even teamed up. And I just really liked that idea of the sort of the water buffalo versus the cheetah. And I guess I never thought that a water buffalo and cheetah would be such great teammates, but in fact, they are.
You know, the farmer and the rancher can be friends.
Yes.
And so I guess, what do you want a reader who might be a lifetime Philly guy like a Lou versus, you know, someone who just has his green card like me for 27 years? What do you want us to sort of walk away? What impression of that era, those players, that dynamic, that team?
Well, I think that there is two separate sort of things that I'm going to be aiming for in this book. One is to sort of place Irving and Malone back in the sort of pantheon of the people that we think about when we think about that era. I do think that the conversation has been so overwhelmed by Magic Johnson and Larry Bird that, yes, you know, it's kind of like Magic and Bird lead the way to Jordan. And it really sort of cuts Irving and Malone, or at least relegates them to footnotes. And I don't think that that's the proper placement for those people. It's very similar to what I did in my first book, where I think that the narrative of Jackie Robinson really overwhelms the other pioneers that were coming into Major League Baseball at the same time: Larry Doby, Satchel Paige, and then Bill Veeck. And then first, the way that I want to sort of tell this book is the way that I told my first book. It's very novelistic. It's very going to be sort of putting you into the action so that you can see both the heartache that Julius Irving has to sort of undergo as he sort of continually comes up short and then sort of seems like, oh no, I'm not going to win it. And then the sort of overwhelming joy, the sort of release that Philadelphia has at that point. And so for a fan in Philly, it would be more sort of a way of taking something that you already know about, which would be that 83 team, and sort of recreating the excitement and the emotional release that team provided the city.
Do you have a name for the book yet?
It's going to be called Moses and the Doctor.
Oh, that's a cool name.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Very nice. And what's the timetable, Luke?
Hopefully it's going to come out in 2025. I actually just signed the contract 2 months ago. So it's in the very early stages right now. And so obviously these things take a little time. But yeah, look forward in like 2 years.
Well, I want to thank you for sending me this book. I'm anxious to read it because I was coming of baseball age when Jackie Robinson came up, and then when Larry Doby came up. And I loved Larry Doby because we had the A's, Philadelphia A's, then, and we used to play Cleveland when they would come here. And I like you, I've always felt he didn't get his due. And it was because Jackie Robinson was God, and this kid was just another peon. But he was more than that. He was a great player and a fine human being. And I'm really anxious to read more about it.
Thanks, Lou. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Hey, and before we go, Luke, obviously you spent a good amount of time with your stringed instrument collection behind you. And so I wonder, that's very impressive. Well, next time we have you on when the book comes out or when it's the rollout, we'll have you play us in and play us out. Have you, over time, just from your southern rural Illinois roots to present, have you assembled, since we are the Museum of Sports show, looking at with the world's largest and most valuable memorabilia collection, have you sort of compiled a little collection of you know, memorabilia?
I have. My dad was very fortunate enough to keep all of his cards from the 40s and 50s. And so I do have all of those sorts of things. I was lucky enough to spend time with several ball players who have since passed away. While researching my first book, Eddie Robinson was one of them. He was the first baseman on the Cleveland Indians in the 40s. Wow. So, yeah, he gave me a couple of mementos from that World Series. And so, yeah, a lot of stuff from that Cleveland team. And it's, I mean, nothing that probably is museum worthy, but a lot of things that are meaningful to me just based on my own research.
Well, what we've been known to do, Lou and I take great joy in sort of scaring the living bejesus out of some of our guests, is the next time we have you come on, we'll have you do a little show and tell and lap overlap into our segment with our King of Sports Collectibles, Nick DiPaccio Jr., who has loved doing these spot appraisals that have knocked some folks completely out of frame there. You were talking about Jackie Robinson, the one fellow I'm going to forget, Ed Rabinowitz? Lou, do you remember his name?
Could be his name.
He was a boy living in the Midwest. His father was a connected Democratic Party attorney. And whenever Jackie Robinson would come to town, he would stay with them. Ed Rabinowitz, I can't remember his last. He developed a very strong friendship with him, has a bunch of pen pal letters. And we had him on with Nick Jr. And Nick said, conservatively, that collection of letters, since they're personalized and there's a wonderful story behind them, he goes, I would start you at about $500,000. So we'll be very interested to maybe have you curate a few of those items, and we'll bring you back on. We'd love
to get
it.
10%, right?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Just see the lady on the way out, Luke. Hey, writer and author Luke Eplin, working on a wonderful piece. What was it? Moses and the Doctor. A wonderful book. Just signed the contract. Looking to come out in 2025. Also the author of Our Team, about the integration of the Cleveland Indians. Luke, thank you so much for being on the Museum of Sports show. Let me know when you've got that curated collection. We'll bring it back on.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Luke.
All right, cool. Thanks, Luke. Look, when we come back, our King of Sports Collectibles, when the Museum of Sports show continues right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. We'll be right back.
Can you imagine Philadelphia without the Broad Street Bullies or its fabled Spectrum Arena? Well, it almost happened until Lou Scheinfeld and Ed Snyder, otherwise known as Flash and Cash, teamed up to rescue the Flyers and got America's Showplace up and running. It was 1967, and the world was in a whole different place. You can read all about it in Lou Scheinfeld's heartfelt memoir, Blades, Bands, and Ballers. Get a signed copy at themuseumofsports.org. Themuseumofsports.org. Blades, Bands, and Ballers, now available. The Museum of Sports Show is presented by DiPaccio Franklin Cardiovascular and Autonomic Center. Dr. Nicholas DiPaccio is a caring specialist who uses natural antioxidants, nitric oxide, and anti-inflammatory agents to treat shortness of breath, brain fog, chronic disease, autonomic dysfunction syndrome, and more with minimum medicines. To learn more, please call Nicholas DiPaccio, MD, FACC, at 856-589-6034. That's 856-589-6034.
Who remembers the Philadelphia A's or the Warriors or the old arena at 46th and Market?
30 seconds,
we
he's coming
do,
back
and
now.
That's why the Museum of Sports is being planned for Philadelphia. What's it like to face a 100-mile-an-hour fastball, ride your bike up the Manhattan Wall, or drive in the Pocono 500? We've got rare items from Babe Ruth, Mike Schmidt, Chuck Bednar, Bernie Perron, and Wilt Chamberlain. The Museum of Sports is on the air, and you can join the fun.
All right, here we go.
Every Thursday, 4 to 5 p.m. on WWDB 860.
Hey, buddy, what can I get you? How about the ultimate sports memorabilia basement?
Welcome back to the Museum of Sports show right here on Talk 860 and Facebook Live. I'm Doug Scheimel along with Lou Scheinfeld. Susan is off this week. Museum of Sports show brought to you by the DiPaccio Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They are the specialists in non-invasive treatment. And up next, you see him right there. He's one of the specialists, our King of Sports Collectibles, whose family has the world's largest and most valuable sports memorabilia collection, conservatively valued in excess of $35 million. And he is our proud partner in the Museum of Sports, Mr. Nick DiPaccio Jr. Hi, Nick.
What's up, guys?
You look so much better when you do the landscape laptop thing.
That's for our people watching on Facebook.
Yeah,
so we just had our we just had author Luke Eplin on, and he's working on a book called Moses and the Doctor about the 82-83 76ers championship team. And he had worked on another book called, what was it, Our Team, Lou, about the integration of the 1948 Cleveland Indians. And I said, well, have you, acquired sports collectibles over time? And he goes, oh, his father kept most of his baseball cards, gave them to him from, what did he say, 30s and 40s, Lou?
Yeah, but the card, he was a St. Louis Browns fan. The Cardinals and the Browns. And, you know, the interesting thing, I didn't get a chance to say it, is that the Cardinals and the Browns met in the World Series and they played in the same park, Sportsman's Park in St. Louis, because it was home to both of them at that time.
What would some of those cards be worth, depending upon if, like, Cleveland, no, the St. Louis Browns cards, are those a dime a dozen? I wouldn't think so, Nick. Are
Ned
they?
Garver.
Any cards from that era are going to be worth money, especially if they're in good condition, if they're graded, and they're graded maybe a 7, 8 or higher. You're probably not going to see too many that are mint condition that are tens, but any cards from that era, as long as they're graded, are going to be worth money. You always want to get your cards graded when they're like that old, when they're vintage.
Are there a lot of St. Louis Browns cards floating around? I'm guessing Luke's dad would probably be, you know, kind of an anomaly, but I mean, are those things, do you see those coming up at auction or no?
I mean, not often, because the Browns were only a franchise until they became the Baltimore Orioles in the 60s, I believe. Lou would remember the when that happened. Do you remember, Lou?
Well, Mercury was in town. He had just won the Olympics in Athens. And he and I went to the game, and Samson lifted our spirits. Yes, I remember.
Well, you lived through good sports moments, that's for sure.
And I'm getting my tooth tomorrow. Tomorrow I get my tooth.
Oh, well, congratulations on that too.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a sad thing. Oh, by the way, top of the third, Phillies are leading the Rangers 4-0.
All righty.
No. Yeah, I saw before Stott hit a home run. He hit a two-run shot, and drove in Castellanos, who we need to actually start hitting this year.
You know what happens if the Phillies lose the opener?
What?
They can't serve beer. Really? They lose the opener.
Gotcha.
Okay, Lou's writing his own stuff. All right, no more of that. So I got to ask you, Nick, we're embarking on a brand new, fresh, crisp, delicious baseball season. What are some things that, like some of the entry-level fans out there could be looking for as, you know, maybe something to pick up for relatively, you know, cheap price now that could have some, you know, collectability the end of the season or into the playoffs or maybe another run at the series?
Yes. Well, I mean, the one thing I want to emphasize is during the baseball season, you do not want to buy baseball cards. During the football season, you don't want to buy football cards. You want to buy them in the off season because that's when the prices are more reasonable. So cards, I would stay away from till the winter. This is actually a good time to buy football cards right now. And I guess that would be the best ones to buy. So So cards we'll just put aside for a moment. And then just in terms of baseball, I mean, when you go to the ballpark, there's collectibles there. They said each stadium more and more they're having game use collectible stands, and you could get some items for a fairly reasonable cost for an entry level buyer. They have game used baseballs that they get signed by the players that hit them. So you want to go after the game used memorabilia, and you could, like I said, you could get stuff pretty cheap. Relatively cheap. You don't have to spend thousands of dollars on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, it's a lot like I think I mentioned X number of shows ago, the U.S. Tennis Open. I go over a year, and you know, going back 5, 6, 7, 8 years, I would buy some of the game used or match used balls by a Rafa or a Federer, or I don't think I have a Djokovic, but those would have been signed and they're enclosed in a little case thing, and those might have been $40-$50 right there at the stadium. And you had said, you know, that those are things that, Match used at the Open and whatever the year was, 2012, 2015, whatever it was, if they happened to win it that year, those could escalate in price. And same thing would apply with, you might just think it's a run of the mill game used ball, but that could amount to something.
Well, especially if it's autographed.
Yeah.
And that I know the Phillies do that. They have they have them like in a basket, and you can. Used to be able to get Chase Utley, Jimmy Rollins. We're going back to that team.
Right.
I mean, today it would be Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber, Aaron Nola. So, and then they also have jerseys, game used jerseys. Now you get the Harpers, the Real Mutos. Those jerseys are going to go for in the thousands, but you could get like for $150, even you could get like a Brandon Marsh game used jersey or something. And
really?
Say you're an entry-level collector. That might be a good way to start. Get a player like that or Bryson Stott or like a starter or like maybe a bullpen guy that gets playing time but isn't a bona fide star yet. And maybe you think someone's going to be a star and you invest early. That's part of it's speculation. If you think somebody has a shot to break through, you're always taking a risk because a few years ago, the guy that people would have thought that way with Scott Kingery. And he never made it to that, to his potential that people thought he had. And he's still young. Maybe he will one day, but yeah, a lot of it's speculation. But that's how you're going to get stuff at a reasonable price.
Let me ask you this. Last week we talked about, the app from Collex, C-O-L-L-X, where you could take your phone and take a picture of the card that you had, a baseball card, and it instantly told you what it was worth. And then they were going to set up a program where you could sell it, you could buy things. Did you have a chance to sneak into the vault?
Honus-Wagner card. No,
I think the app would explode if you did the Honus-Wagner
card. But like I said, I did do the John Kruk card. So.
Oh, okay.
I don't have it right with me. I actually have it in the office because I brought it in the one day. But it was like, I think I told you it was like $1.29, let's say, or something, $1.50.
That's a bargain at any price.
Yeah. Well, it's not graded. And say you have like 100 of those cards, you could sell them for $100.
Is that the only one you did?
That's the only one I did that day. But I have a stack in the other room. We don't have enough time for me to go get them right now, probably.
Well, I gave you a week. How much more time do you want?
I had to pull an all-nighter with studying. So homework didn't get done.
Yeah. So I know Doug wants me to ask the weekly question. Has mom let you guys buy anything or can you show us anything that you recently received?
So we are taking a hiatus on buying for now. I emphasize for now. We're focusing on putting funds into finishing the museum, the DiPaggio Sports Museum.
Yep. So
that is actually our priority right now. And he keeps throwing dates out there, but we're looking like realistically, a June opening is going to happen.
Fantastic.
So that's the priority right now is opening that museum and sharing the artifacts that we already have that we need to display.
Now, will you have some of those items you got from the last Super Bowl with the Eagles? I know you said you were kind of awaiting delivery on those. Did those show up yet?
From the auction from the Super Bowl.
Right.
Yeah, they had to go pick Arteo and Eric Katz, who you've seen on the show.
Oh, sure.
Curator. They had to go pick them up in Pennsylvania at Haunt Auction's warehouse. So they did go pick it up. And
are they back yet?
They're sitting in our storage warehouse. Yeah, they got bad. Well, Art's in the Philippines now, so
better. Well, refresh our memory. What did you get from that auction?
We got a Walter Payton, a bunch of Walter Payton memorabilia.
That's right.
One of them was that novelty award, but there was also a real award where he won Offensive Player of the Year. We got Gino Marchetti's collection. We got some items from that.
Now, there's a name you haven't heard in a while.
Yeah.
His collection, they had quite a few pieces from his collection. And and we did walk away with some good memorabilia from that. And then some odds and ends here and there. We got a game issued Justin Herbert jersey, the game used one. So game issued means they can't prove it was worn on the field, but it's got all the right tags.
But he'll have what, three jerseys a game, just in case one gets unplayable or something, or damaged in some form, or has to be cut off of them or something.
Exactly. And game issued, oftentimes they are game used, but they have to say game issued because it's not 100% proven.
Right.
Most of the items we have are game used, but every now and then it's worth it to get a game issued. And for an entry level collector, that might be worth it too, to go after a game issued jersey.
And what would that go for? It's not cheap, but it's still within reach.
Yeah. Well, with Justin Herbert, I mean, his game used jerseys are going for over 40,000. So yeah. So the game issue though, is, I think we paid maybe about 10 to 15. So it is less, but it's still, you still have to pay. But if you're going for a player that's not on his caliber, you're not going to be paying that 15,000 for game issued. You might be paying $400 or $500.
Yeah. What about, with the signing of a Marcus Mariota, is that what's happened to his value on the auction market?
No, I really don't think it's been affected.
Has that just sort of been bumping along the bottom, I'm guessing?
Yeah. I mean, his memorabilia peaked when he was drafted second overall. And it basically went down from there. But if you invested in him on draft day, you would have lost a few bucks there, but you know what? Yeah, he's not old. But he's a backup. Obviously he's backing up Jalen Hurts. Yeah. So he's not going to be a starter, but maybe this propels him into being a starter if he can get a few games starting with the Eagles, because Hurts might be out for one or two games. Yeah. And that's how guys get more chances in the league. Yeah,
exactly. Well, you've got a week to bring back the Collects app and the cards from the stack. So
a week.
Look at that. Maybe got.
7 days.
Wait. Next week, I will not be able to join the show.
Oh, dear. All right. Then you have 2 weeks.
Next week, I will be in the Magic Kingdom with my son.
Oh, very good. Oh, that's right.
My mom's brothers. Yeah.
His seventh birthday, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Today is his seventh birthday.
Congrats.
Yes.
Congrats. Right. Well, happy birthday in advance. That's all the time we've got this week.
You.
I want to thank our guests, authors and sports writers, Sam Carcisi and Luke Eplin, and of course, our king of sports collectibles, Mr. Nick DiPaccio Jr. And don't forget to buy Lou's new book, Blades, Bands, and Ballers, How Flash and Cash Rescued the Flyers and Created Philadelphia's Greatest Showplace. You can get your custom autograph copy by going to themuseumofsports.org, and Lou will pen an autograph and a little note himself. Portion of the proceeds benefits the Museum of Sports. The Museum of Sports Show brought to you by the DiPaccio Franklin Cardiovascular Center. They're specialists in non-invasive treatment. For Lou Scheinfeld, Susan Baxter, and Nick DiPaccio Jr., I'm Doug Scheimel, reminding you of what our good friend Carly Simon always says, Lou.
These are the good old days.
They sure are.
These are
See you next week. Have fun at Disney.
Guys.